from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. This week, journalist Joe Eskenazi published a story in SF Weekly that seems to have struck a nerve. It was about the seemingly innocuous topic of service animals, the animals we typically think of as the ones who assist the blind in crossing the street. But the article detailed how anyone with a doctor's note can get their pet registered as a service animal. And not just dogs. Lizards, birds, even rodents can get registered too. And armed with that official paperwork, owners can take those animals just about anywhere. So are regulations for service animals being abused in San Francisco, or are all those animals exactly what the doctor ordered for people with special needs? Animals on Board, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Have you ever gotten a bus on a bus in San Francisco and spotted someone who seems disability-free, yet has a dog or another animal alongside? Perhaps you've wondered, what gives? Reporter Joe Eskenazi wondered about that too, why it was that people who looked able-bodied were able to take animals onto buses and into restaurants, including animals that sometimes weren't exactly well-behaved. His report in this week's edition of SF Weekly spells out what's behind the seemingly growing menagerie of animals on board and at the dinner table. It turns out that all you need to get a service animal designation is a note from a doctor saying the animal is necessary for your well-being. And by law, the city must grant your request, no questions asked. On the plus side, it means that people with serious mental health needs, for example, not just those with physical disabilities, can be comforted by their pets wherever they choose to go. But as Joe Eskenazi's report details, it can also mean that untrained animals, even animals that have attacked people in the past, can legally accompany their owners just about anywhere. It's a topic that causes no small amount of consternation in the disabled community, in public spaces, and no doubt on our airwaves this morning as well. Joining us to talk about it this morning, Joe Eskenazi, staff writer for SF Weekly. His article, Service with a Snarl, appears in this week's edition of the paper. Joe, good morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Happy to have you with us. Joining us, too, is Jessie Lorenz. She's director of public policy for Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired. It's the largest agency providing direct services to the blind and visually impaired community in Northern California. Jessie Lorenz, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you join us. Joining us, too, is Susan Misner. She's director of the Mayor's Office on Disability, which works to ensure that city-operated services, programs, and facilities are fully accessible to people with disabilities. Susan Misner, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have all of you here. Joe, let's walk through some of what you found out in your report that appears in this week's SF Weekly. First of all, I think what many found probably curious in reading your report is that there is no test that has to be taken. It's simply a matter of request. If someone walks in with their animal with a note from their doctor to the Animal Care and Control Office, they have to give that designation, right? There's no further questioning that has to be done.
That is mostly correct. First of all, Animal Care and Control only gives tags for dogs. Not other animals. But those other animals, you don't need to have any kind of designation by the city or county to call it a service animal. My understanding, and I'm glad Susan's here, is that they well check to see that the dog has its rabies shots and other things like that. You couldn't bring in a wolf, for example, because it's impossible to inoculate it from rabies. But you could bring in a wolf mix. And the content of the note can be very general. It could just say, this dog is needed by my patient to treat his disability. As simple as that. As long as it's on the letterhead of a doctor, and they will go through and you will sign a form. I actually have one with me that just states that you know that it's fraud if it's not valid under penalty of misdemeanor. And that's that.
And so it could be for mental health needs. It could be for one example you cite in your article is it was someone who got a note from their dentist saying that if they didn't have their dog with them, that their jaws got locked up. So it could be really for any purpose.
There is no, as far as I can tell, there is no boundary. It could be whatever it is. And the term that came up to me from animal control staff is we do not have any discretion in whether to give or not give. If you follow the rules and come in with the note and your animal has been inoculated,
I hope I'm using that term right, then yes, you will get the tags.
Now, you mentioned in your article and just recently that it's not just a question of dogs. We usually associate service animals with dogs, but indeed they can be other kinds of animals. And while the city doesn't provide that designation, if I were to carry around in my hip pocket a note from my doctor saying it's okay with the doctor saying this person needs to carry around this pet whatever on the bus, in a restaurant, in an apartment building that's otherwise pet-free. That's all I need? Give us an example of the kinds of things that you found that people were able to take with them.
Well, you don't need the doctor's note with you. It's been my understanding under the Americans with Disabilities Act is that it would be burdensome in order to ask someone for documentation of their disability every time they want to go into a restaurant or a bus.
You just have to have that note somewhere.
It has to theoretically exist. You do need to present it to your landlord in order to get a reasonable accommodation to live in your building. Some of the things that I was told about, I met people who had iguanas and snakes and various rodents. I was told that this is in the story, that a woman presented her landlord with a doctor's note that said that since she was unable to conceive and express the maternal instinct, she needed to be able to breed successive generations of hamsters. And this was the landlords decided it wasn't worth the trouble of fighting it. As far as accommodations in public, I am not certain where the term reasonable accommodation is used. So if someone brought a zebra or something onto a bus, that couldn't happen. You know, that goes beyond the bounds of a reasonable accommodation. But very large dogs, snakes, rats. These are things that you could take onto a bus.
And perhaps most concerning about your article, you document a number of cases where there are people, in this case dogs, that aren't terribly well behaved, that in fact are dogs that have bit others in the past, but because they provide this special service, they're still allowed to be out in public.
That's correct. And it's something that that people have commented on the article that I didn't explicitly mention, that a misbehaving service animal can be asked to leave the premises. And that is true. That's true in the case of a trained guide dog or someone's chihuahua or a unusual animal that makes a scene. What people told me again and again, be they police, be they restaurateurs, be they security guards, etc., is that it's often not worth the trouble because people will threaten you with a lawsuit and the law enforcement agency feels intimidated, and they will, unless it's a really disruptive scene, they'll just let it go. That is, I think, at the heart of a lot of people's anger.
Jess Ganassi, reporter for San Francisco Weekly, that put together this story this week about whether or not in the city of San Francisco we're striking the right balance between the needs of people with disability, the need for their service animals, or whether or not people are beginning to in some ways game the system and go too far with it. Let's widen out our conversation now and fold in some other points of view about this. Susan Misner at the mayor's office on disability. In some ways, this begins to feel like only in San Francisco could this take place, you know, and yet as I read about this story. In fact, this debate has gone on in Fort Worth, Texas, in Albany, New York, in Honolulu, Hawaii, and on across the country. How are you trying to balance this? How do you view this sort of dilemma as one about supporting people with disabilities legitimately and yet not wanting to push the envelope too far?
I think the issue that has not been explained sufficiently is that there are real limits on how support and service animals need to behave. Support and service animals are expected to not be aggressive, not be disruptive, not have any pose any health hazard. And those are real and acceptable limits. I want to step back for a second because I think, you know, Joe has done his research. He's really spent a lot of time on this article, and he's a reporter. He needs to write something that's going to create news. He's made it a bit of a sensationalist issue. But frankly, service and support animals are an incredible tool for people with disabilities. We define them differently. Service animals are defined in statute and regulation as an animal that's been individually trained to provide a service for a person. Now, what most of us are used to with that is a service animal for someone who is blind, a guide dog. But as Joe and you have pointed out, there are many different types of services that animals can provide. And it is really a wonderful thing to understand how much that capacity provides. So there are let me just give a couple more examples. I mean, there are birds who stay on the shoulder of their owner, and if the owner has a disability, will hop down and retrieve dropped keys. Or there are dogs that alert deaf people to the doorbell ringing or a siren. There are even dogs who have trained themselves. They haven't been trained, but have trained themselves to be able to detect when an owner is about to have a seizure. And then they can alert the owner, and the owner will be able to get themselves to a safe place, let someone else know that they may be having a seizure. Those are service animals. Support animals we define differently, and they really are not protected in statute and regulatory law. They're protected in case law. Support animals are for people with psychiatric disabilities. They also provide amazing services. Someone who has agoraphobia may not be able to leave their house without their support animal.
I understand the points that you're making, and it is important to sort of widen our context here and hear all of the possibilities that are provided by these animals, be they support animals or service animals, following the distinction that you're making. But would you also acknowledge, Susan Misner, that sometimes this can go too far? When you read about someone who says, I have to have my pet with me because otherwise my jaws hurt, when you read about having someone who takes a pet out in public that misbehaves, isn't there a need perhaps to balance more back on the other side?
I think we need to talk about psychiatric disabilities and the stigma that is attached to psychiatric disabilities. There are going to be lots of people who say, I need this support animal, not because of a psychiatric disability, but of a physical one. And someone who has an anxiety disorder may, in fact, have such anxiety that their jaws start to hurt if their support animal isn't with them.
Yeah, fascinating. Jesse Lawrence, as someone who works specifically with the blind and visually impaired, how do you view this? Is there a sense at all within the people that you work with, a kind of frustration or resentment that some people might be sort of pushing this too far compared to the very highly trained services that a dog provides for someone who's visually impaired?
Well, let's just start with training. And in California, training of dog guides is something that's quite rigorous. There's the Guide Dog Board of California, which regulates the type of training that both the dog and the individual with vision loss have to go through in order to be an actual guide dog team here in California. Guide dogs are exposed to stimulus to make sure that they're not going to be aggressive or that they're not going to react sometimes when dogs are afraid, they bolt, and that would not be a good behavior to have in a guide dog when it's exposed to something that it's afraid of. And I think that there is definitely feelings within the community of service animal users that many of our dogs have undergone rigorous training, breeding, have been exposed to different types of stimulus. And when you're taking a dog that may have been picked up from the pound, may or may not have had behavior training, it's sort of an unknown entity. You don't know if that dog's going to be aggressive in public. You don't know if that dog is going to react funny when it sees a baby in a stroller or someone using a walker, for example. And so the concern is public safety. Additionally, dog guides have been trained to such a high standard of behavior. And that's because we have the privilege of being able to access things like restaurants, airplanes. A guide dog can go anywhere that its handler can go. And that's a privilege that was earned because of the way that these dogs behave. They're not supposed to be disruptive. They're not supposed to bark. They're not supposed to growl. And if they do, then they're legally allowed to be excluded from the the agency or the place of, in public.
So is there a sense within your the people, again, that you work with, that whereas your service animals have not only been trained, that it's a privilege that's been earned through a lot of work and training, and that in some cases now in San Francisco and elsewhere around the country, that people are sort of getting away with something that hasn't been earned? Is that the sense?
I think that there are problems on multiple levels. I think that the Department of Justice needs to clarify the definition and the legal rights entailed for folks who have companion and support dogs versus task trained service animals. So that's one thing. There's the Department of Justice has not the definition is not clear enough. Secondly, I think we need to look at the medical community. If someone in the medical community is writing a prescription saying or a note saying that this person needs an animal or a bird in order to function and live more in a more integrated way, has this person in the medical community seen the animal to determine whether or not it's dangerous? And then thirdly, our own departments of animal care and control, has the animal been evaluated by someone who understands dogs or understands animals? Has the animal been seen to be aggressive? Has the animal demonstrated that it can act in a public space in a way that's not going to be aggressive or disruptive?
Well, let's get a viewpoint on that now from Rebecca Katz, who's the acting director of the San Francisco Department of Animal Care and Control. And Rebecca Katz, thanks for joining us briefly this morning. But you heard Jesse Lorenz just make a couple of comments that I'd like you to speak to as well. To what extent can you evaluate animals that are brought in? If someone brings in their dog with a note from their doctor saying this person is entitled to have this dog with them, can you do any kind of evaluation, or do you simply have to say you're good to go?
The program, as we've established it, allows us to provide people with it's, and it's not, as Joe said, not just any animal, it's dogs in particular, that we provide dog assistance tags based on the doctor's note and the affidavit that the individual signs saying that their dog has been trained to provide a service. We don't evaluate the dogs behaviorally. However, as Joe's article noted, we do have a unrelated system, but related in the sense that we have a vicious and dangerous dog unit that has an investigatory function. When we get complaints from members of the public about a dog's behavior, we investigate those complaints, and we can have hearings to determine whether or not the dog poses a public safety risk.
Would you like to have more authority to evaluate animals, to make the kind of assessments that Jesse Lorenz was suggesting?
You know, I think having our vicious and dangerous dog unit allows us to make those evaluations where we receive complaints. But in terms of an initial assessment, you know, we're not in a position to determine diagnostically what a person's needs are, and we leave that to their medical provider to assess what their needs are. And we prefer that because we're not in a position to know what is necessary, what tasks the person needs performed, and so forth. So that's where we've sort of left it. We've left the parameters a little bit wide intentionally because we don't have the skills to assess what people's needs are.
Rebecca Katz, acting director of the San Francisco Department of Animal Care and Control. If you would, Rebecca, if you can, please stay with us. We're going to be opening up our conversation to phone calls and emails in just a few minutes, and I'm sure people would like to be able to pose questions to you as well. Joe Skenazzi of SF Weekly, let's come back to your perspective on this, because we've laid out now sort of all of the different nuances of this debate, the kind of balancing act that's involved. And you just heard Rebecca Katz say that she really doesn't want to be able to do more assessment of whether an animal has been trained, whether an animal is dangerous. That's what the enforcement authority of her division does. From your reporting, is that sufficient?
I can't say whether or not it's sufficient, but I can say it's problematic. I don't fault Rebecca at all. I think that she is following the law as it's written. As it's written, a vicious and dangerous dog, so designated by the Vicious and Dangerous Animal Unit of the Animal Control and the SFPD, can legally obtain service dog tags and be taken into a restaurant.
So let's make sure we get this clear. You could have an animal that's been designated vicious and still take it with you into a restaurant so long as it's been designated as a service or support animal?
Yes, you can. The caveats that come with a vicious and dangerous dog still apply. You would still have to, say, put a muzzle on this dog, but you would be entitled to take it onto the bus for free. You would be entitled to take it into a public accommodation, etc. The problem here, so far as I can tell, and there may not be a solution for this, is that the rules look at the needs of the person, not at the behavior of an animal. The contention that I made in my story is that it's problematic money-wise, staff-wise, and as far as legal indemnity for anyone such as the animal control to determine this dog is acceptable. If they determine this dog is acceptable and then the dog bites somebody, that puts the city on the hook legally. And as I mentioned in the story, the assistance dog tags, which, by the way, are not mandatory. You can take your dog virtually anywhere you please without the tags and just tell people it's a service animal. The tags don't signify the city says your dog is a service animal. It signifies you have sworn this dog to be a service animal and signed an affidavit.
Well, this points out some problems, does it not, Susan Misner? I mean, duly noted that San Francisco has a lot of budgetary needs right now, and this may or may not climb to the top of the priority list. But if you're able to take a dog that's been designated vicious into a restaurant and just sort of be able to say, it's my service animal, doesn't that point out a problem?
I think that this, again, is being a little bit sensationalized. We have many more phone calls about people who are denied entrance to a restaurant, a bus, a taxi cab, which happened to Jesse on the way over here this morning, because they have a service animal that is well-behaved or a support animal that is well-behaved than people who have problems with service animals that are difficult.
I just want to make sure I'm taking your point right, which is that we're focusing, in your view, on a very occasional problem and granting it far larger import than it should, because the bigger problem, in your view, is the opposite. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, I think that Joe in his article said that San Francisco is exquisitely sensitive to disability issues. And I take that as a compliment. I am thrilled that San Francisco is exquisitely sensitive to disability rights issues. We're the birthplace of the disability rights movement. And 20 years ago, it wasn't the service animal that was being denied entrance into that restaurant or that museum. It was the person with a disability.
Yeah. Jesse Lorenz, we're going to our break here in just 30 seconds or so, and we'll hear the music that will signal that. But weigh in on this. We've heard this balance, this need for context, the need that Susan Misner eloquently describes for people with disabilities. And yet you have this sense that sometimes this just goes too far. How do you see it?
I am,
and I should add, I'm sorry for the benefit of our audience, that you are someone who's visually impaired, whose dog is sitting next to you this morning.
That's true. For me, it comes down to access. My dog is a highly trained dog that is essentially a tool that helps me navigate the environment safely. This morning, on my way here, in 2009 in San Francisco, a cab refused to take me. And there's definitely a feeling within folks in the blind community that if we didn't have so many folks using support animals, that the access for folks who are blind would be a little bit better.
Let's hold it there, and we'll come back in just a moment and take your calls as well. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the use of service animals and support animals in the city of San Francisco. Are we taking too much advantage of those regulations that allow people with just a doctor's note to say that their animal provides that support? Or is it an important function that we need to be broadly framed and broadly minded about so that people who do have special needs can get the support, comfort, and service that animals can provide? That's our topic. We'd like to hear from you, your thoughts on this, your experience with this. Are you someone who feels like these rights have gone too far, or someone who feels like we need to be more understanding of those things. What's been your experience in restaurants or public places? What if you're a landlord? We welcome your calls. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. Right before the break, Susan Misner, Jesse Lorenz was making the point that, yes, indeed, she had someone not want to take her with her and her dog with them in their cab. But her point is that that would be less likely to happen if this wasn't quite so widely and broadly construed in the city of San Francisco, that there's so much of this going on that cab drivers, whoever, have become a little bit wary. Your response?
With respect, I don't think that's the reason that cab drivers don't take someone with a clearly labeled guide dog for someone who is blind with a harness on it. I think it is years and years of just discrimination against people with disabilities. And I want to just reemphasize that tags and harnesses and signs or coats for dogs are a convenience for the person with a disability. They are not required. I think Joe has pointed this out. It's a convenience because otherwise the person with a disability has to explain, this is a service animal. I'm a person with a disability. Every time they get on the bus, every time they walk into a store, every time they want to sit down at a restaurant, that is a huge burden. And I will also just go to the top of the hour when you were talking about people on buses with animals. Anyone can take their pet onto a bus. They just are supposed to pay the fare for them. So I think
they're supposed to be muzzled, correct? If they're not a service designated
as
a service
not,
animal.
Right. So I believe that we probably have many more problems from uncontrolled animals that are not service or support animals than we do from the service and support animals.
Let's hear what our listeners think about this topic this morning. Let's go first to Ron, who joins us in San Francisco. Ron, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a landlord. And as I understand, someone could come with a ferret or an iguana and say that this is a support animal, and I would be obliged to rent to them. Is that true?
Ron, thanks for the question. Joe, you looked into some of the situations involving landlords in your article. Your thoughts?
This is an intriguing question because my understanding is that ferrets are illegal in the state of California. So I'm not sure if that supersedes a federal regulation on service animals. As far as the iguana, yes. That would be considered a reasonable accommodation. There are a number of intriguing elements to this. You're only allowed to have four animals in a unit in San Francisco, even if it's your private residence. So I don't know how that ordinance would fare in court next to someone who claimed and had doctors backing that he or she needed more as service animals. So, but to answer Ron's question, the iguana, certainly. The ferret, I'm really not sure. My guess would be that if he asked a landlord attorney, the landlord attorney would tell him to acquiesce.
And much of your reporting goes to that point, which is that basically the advice that landlords have gotten from their attorneys are, you know, you really can't challenge this. You might want to, but you're going to lose. Just if someone says, don't even have to have proof that this is a service animal, you just have to go with it.
In the case of a landlord, you do need proof insofar as a doctor's note. It's only in cases where someone has made really outlandish claims that it's worth challenging and that you stand the chance of winning. One lawyer I talked to did win a case in which a woman claimed that her cat could detect seizures. There had never, at least according to this lawyer, there's never been any documentable evidence that a cat can do this. Dogs certainly can. And they did win that case. It also bears mentioning that this was the third cat that this woman had brought onto the property in a no-pets building. So cases like that, yes, a landlord stands a chance of winning. Something as pedestrian as just wanting a lizard, no.
Joe Scanasi, who reported this week on this topic for SF Weekly. Again, the number, if you'd like to join us, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Susan Misner, go ahead.
I just want to tell Ron and other landlords that and I need to reemphasize this over and over again, landlords do not have to accept animals that are misbehaving, disruptive, or a health hazard. So Ron, if you have someone whose dog has fleas or who's barking all night long, it doesn't matter whether they're a service or support animal. It doesn't matter how many tags they have. That's not an animal that is protected under the law.
Some emails coming in. Dana writes, this entire situation seems so problematic and mishandled, although I hear the point that untrained animals are not a widespread public danger. But a physician, a psychologist, or a psychiatrist is just as unqualified to assess a dog's behavior as the animal control office is unqualified to assess the needs of the person with the impairment. Tom writes in, I was raised with dogs and trained to wash my hands after I touch the dogs. It's a simple precaution. Whenever I see a person who can see and walking through the produce section of the supermarket with their dog, I can't help wondering about the kind of health risks that might pose. Enough is enough. And Wanda writes, please ask your guests about doctors who, for a price, will write the note that clears in an animal. Is that how much of a concern is that, Susan, that the doctors are just not taking this issue seriously enough? That's sort of the sense you get from some of Joe's reporting, that the doctors are just too cavalier about this.
I have no way of judging how cavalier doctors are. I think it is certainly an area that would be great to explore and some education for the medical community. But I will tell you, I mean, we have, according to the 2000 census, more than 36,000 people with psychiatric disabilities in San Francisco. And I doubt we have 36,000 support animals.
Back to our callers. Jesse, did you want to add something? Go ahead.
I think the role that the medical community plays in this issue is one that we need more. We need to explore more.
Your view is that it's just been done too casually?
That is my view, yes.
Jessie Lorenz joining us this hour for Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired. She joins us along with Susan Misner, Director of the Mayor's Office on Disability. Joe Eskenazi, staff writer for SF Weekly. Rebecca Katz is hanging with us as well, Acting Director of the San Francisco Department of Animal Care and Control. So if you have a question specifically about animal care and control in San Francisco, Rebecca Katz can answer those questions too. Let's go next to Susan in San Francisco. Susan, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for this important program. First of all, anecdotally, I've ridden Muni for over three decades, and San Francisco is a great restaurant town, eat in restaurants a good half the time. I've never encountered a problem, either on Muni or in restaurants. I've traveled widely in Europe. Animals are often in restaurants. There's just not a problem. As far as the disability issue, somebody said that we're all disabled, we just haven't experienced it yet, and that sooner or later, something's going to happen. It may be visible, or it may be invisible. I have many friends who are disabled, both visible disabilities and disabilities that are not as readily apparent. They're service animals and they're pets. It's the difference between night and day, the difference that it has made in their lives, their sense of self in the world, their sense of safety. I'm really sort of appalled that people are so petty and small to make this an issue. I'm really very chagrined.
Susan, thank you. Yeah,
so thanks.
Thanks
yeah.
for the observation
yeah,
for adding your views on this topic. We appreciate it. Adair joins us next in San Francisco, who's a psychiatrist. Adair, go ahead.
Hi,
Santa Rosa, go ahead.
Thank you. I've practiced in San Francisco for a number of years, and I was asked often about filling out the forms to have patients be able to have service animals. And I frankly felt just really unprepared. I didn't know what the guidelines were, what the cutoff should be. And I felt that I was actually a little bit reluctant to fill it out because oftentimes I had patients who would ask for things that felt like they didn't make sense to me, like patients with a history of violence interested in having sort of aggressive dogs to keep others away from them. And that was really, you know, those cases were few and far between, but it left me feeling reluctant to fill them out because I just wasn't sure what my role was and how to go about doing it. And I think education would be wonderful for the psychiatric community as far as, you know, what our role is, how we can help, because obviously that's what we're interested in doing.
Adair, thank you. Just one quick question back to you. How much of this is a topic of conversation among your colleagues? Is this something that comes up? Are people wondering about how they really should try to respond to these requests?
You know, it is. is, I used to practice on the East Coast, and in Boston, it was not an issue that came up very frequently. But since coming to the West Coast, and especially San Francisco, and up in Sonoma County now, it is something we talk a lot about because the community is very interested in supporting patients and their needs and folks with disabilities and out here. And that's wonderful. And it's exciting to me to be a part of that. But I still do feel like, you know, there's a lot that I need to learn about it.
Adair, thanks. Very much along the lines of what you were saying earlier, Jesse Lorenz, that there's a need for the medical community to take this up. Is this something that you've thought about from your advocacy point of view, trying to bring forward in a way of public education or professional education, rather, with professionals like the caller?
Anecdotally, I've certainly heard stories of medical professionals who don't feel like they have the adequate tools to assess whether or not the animal or the person actually qualify as a service animal and handler team. So I think it's incumbent upon the disability rights community to work with the medical establishment to create those tools. The doctors want what's best for their patients. The person with the disability wants to be able to live in the most integrated, independent setting. And so balancing all of that with this dog that also needs to meet a certain standard of behavior and actually be able to mitigate the impact of someone's disability. It's tough, but I think we can do it.
There's another need that's come up that you referenced earlier, Jesse Lorenz, and Joe Eskenazi, maybe you can weigh in on this and help us sort out the language of the law. We've talked about the requirements of the American for Disabilities Act and that it seems fairly general. There was an attempt, right, to try to sharpen the language about that, to make the sort of distinctions that Jesse is talking about between what counts and what doesn't, but that's been put on the back burner. Is that correct?
Well, I'll be happy to weigh in. I think Susan would be the expert here. Last year, in a notice of – I'm not entirely – I believe the term is notice of proposed change, which has its own acronym naturally coming from Washington, D.C., that they would have the Department of Justice, which administers the ADA, would have made a very clear distinction between an emotional support animal and a service animal, and also would have said that certain animals such as iguanas and barnyard animals and rodents are not acceptable service animals. Going back to Susan's point, there are differences in writing between what a service animal is and what a support animal is. But as she brings up, according to case law, your rights to take the animal places, to live in certain places, is identical. Certainly that's how the draft proposal I've seen out of your office, Susan, looks. That, you know, the terms may be different, service animal or support animal, but the term service animal is used as an umbrella term. There really is no difference, and that's what I've heard from the Department of Human Rights and all that.
Would you like more distinction coming, whether it comes from Washington or wherever, Susan Misner, about what counts and what doesn't?
No. I wouldn't. I would like more education about how service and support animals are expected to behave, and so that the public and restaurant owners feel more empowered to say, your animal's misbehaving, it's not under your control, it's being aggressive, that animal needs to leave. But in terms of a hierarchy of disability, I wouldn't want to privilege people who have physical disabilities and have a service animal that's trained to assist them with a physical disability over people with psychiatric disabilities who may have an animal that's just as well trained, just as well behaved, and serves such an important function in them being able to work, to get out, to be a part of society.
Rebecca Katz at Animal Control and Care, weigh in on that too. Would you like to see a distinction so that you would have a little bit more leeway in whatever designations your office grants?
No, I don't think so. I actually, I have a bias, obviously, because of the work I do and how much I love animals. But we see the palliative effects that having animals provide for people all the time. And frankly, you know, given the number of dogs in particular in San Francisco, the number of complaints about misbehaving dogs is significantly low. And so I think, as Susan said, this is a little bit blown out of proportion because we don't get so many complaints about service animals acting out, and we see how much emotional and physical support animals provide people. So we're not really seeing this as a huge problem here in San Francisco.
It sounds, Jesse Lorenz, like the argument for your suggestion that there ought to be greater clarity here is that it's a slippery slope, and that if you start trying to draw too many fine distinctions between a well-trained seeing eye assistant, as you have with you today, a dog, and the guy who needs his pet iguana for emotional support, that it just gets too tricky. It gets into this hierarchy of whose needs are greater than another. How do you respond to that?
I think that one of the things that Joe stated earlier that I want to reiterate is we're not just talking about animals for people with psychiatric disabilities. A guide dog that growls and bites, or a support comfort animal that growls or bites, was never an intended beneficiary of the law. So I don't like the idea of setting this up like it, as though it's a hierarchy of disability. What I am proud to be a part of is a service animal community where there is a high standard of training and behavior and also accountability. And I think those are the things that we need to work a little bit more rigorously on here in San Francisco.
Would you concur with that part, Susan? Absolutely. Misner? So more training, more accountability is part of what needs to come forward?
Absolutely.
Back to our calls. Let's hear next from John in Oakland. John, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a small service animal. Her name is Belfast. She's a Maltese. And I know there was a dog trainer before the email who was told to always wash their hands after they touch the dog. But now I'm not saying I'm an expert, because I'm not, but I know that my dog can lick a wound and it's healed the next day. I understand that dog saliva is very antiseptic. And another thing is, you know,
And there she is, agreeing with you, no doubt.
Oh, yes, Dogs don't sweat. You know, people do. I think dogs are cleaner than most people.
Okay, John, thanks. Thanks for the call and the observations. Any experts here on the health efficacy of dog saliva? Okay, we'll move on then. Karen joins us next in Richmond. Karen, go ahead.
Hi. I think all of this is fine, but you're all disregarding a really important thing. The more dogs are around, the more that people are allowed to bring their dogs into various places, you're actually reducing accommodation for people who are allergic to them. And some people have really severe allergies, very severe reactions. And, you know, so the more animals that are allowed into public places because someone needs them, and you are actually reducing the ability of others to go to those places. And I have to say, it strikes me that certainly there are people who have a genuine need for service animals, but I think there does need to be a hierarchy of need.
Karen, we're breaking up. We're losing your call, your cell a bit. I know you're on the Richmond Bridge, but I think we've got the gist of it. So let me let you go, if I might, and get Susan Misner to respond. Fair point, that having those, in a sense, can reduce the rights of others who have other health concerns.
We've actually had this issue come up a couple of times in city government. And really what happens in terms of allergic responses tends to be when someone is in contact with the fur or dander from a service or support dog or cat. If this is an education and training issue, that service and support animals should not be on seats, on couches. They need to stay on the floor. They need to not be rubbing up against people. We found with people who have severe allergies, as long as those guidelines are followed, there isn't any problem.
Teresa in San Francisco, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My son was the recent victim of a violent crime, which left him paralyzed. And so his dog is more than he does more than just provide one service. He provides many services. And I understand where the landlords and restaurant owners are coming from, because I've witnessed people with, say, their own street-type pet that they've now have been classified as a guide or service dog get on the buses, and the dog kind of loses, you know, they lose control of the animal, which gives people who really need these dogs a bad rep.
Yeah.
So as your guest was saying, I do truly believe Behavioral training for any dog that's classified as a guide or service dog should be mandatory to me, because they can lose control if they're not trained to do certain things. Your guest hit it right on the head. I mean, training is really key here, and you can't just get a note saying, okay, I need a dog because I have issues with, you know, my health. You should have a seriously trained dog. Otherwise, it gives the people who really need them a bad rep.
Teresa, thank you. Thanks for the call and the observation, and best of luck with your situation and the dog that's clearly needed to help that individual. There seems to be sort of an evolving consensus here that while it may be very difficult to split hairs about the particular need that someone has, that there is some consensus about the need for better training and to make sure that there's accountability for those animals. What's your sense of that, Joe Eskenazi?
Well, I think that if everybody follows the rules work out well. I think the Mayor's Office on Disability does a great job making sure that people have legitimate accommodation. Animal control certainly is following the rules. And might I add that I'm sure animal control is in favor of anything that will lead to more pets being adopted and therefore living healthy, like normal lives. The problem is that the rules as they are very easy to game. And there is almost no recourse to call people for breaking those rules. And a lot of what I've heard from people is, well, what's the harm? Dogs go everywhere in Europe, which, by the way, is a surprise to every European I've talked to. And by the way, the notion of reinforcing access rules in Europe with large personal lawsuits is completely alien to their culture. But to get back to it, it's very easy for disingenuous people to get around these rules, and while some of the examples that we've brought up might be unusual and perhaps even extreme, they are in no way prevented. But tightening it is very hard. There's just almost no recourse to catch people.
Why is it? I guess I'm confused about. I understand the difficulty in sort of sorting out one disability trumps another and one person's need are greater than another. But why is it so hard, Susan Misner, to have a regulation that says if you want a service animal for whatever need, great, but that animal has to go through a training process?
Well, the law does say that the animal has to be under the person's control and cannot be disruptive or
But wouldn't it be good to have a requirement to prove that, to go through a training progress?
The issue is that you can have an animal that's gone through a lot of training and would still be disruptive, or you can have an animal that hasn't had any training and is perfectly obedient and under the owner's control.
Well, sure, but that's a bit like saying, you know, you can still have an accident if you have a driver's license, but you still have to have a driver's license. You still have to have gone through some training to demonstrate your skill before you go out on the highway.
Right, and there are still plenty of people who have driver's licenses who drive drunk, who drive too fast. It's no guarantee that there's going to be behavioral compliance. And I think, again, this is one of these tempests in a teapot. I'm really pleased that Joe's raised this issue so we can talk about service and support animals.
But you wouldn't agree, would you, Jesse Lawrence, that it's a tempest in a teapot? I mean, you really believe strongly that there does need to be higher standards, more accountability, more training.
I do agree that there needs to be higher standards, more training, more accountability. But also, the Department of Justice needs to look at its own regulations around service and support dogs. And there was the notice for proposed rulemaking that went out last year. When the Obama administration came on board, they put that on hold. I hope that Department of Justice takes it up again.
And back to our calls. Laura in San Francisco, you're next. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Laura. And I have a disability. I have a neurological disorder, and I have a service dog. And what I find about my dog's behavior, we're talking about being well-trained and being under the owner's control, is that when I bring him in public, let's say to run an errand to a store or a pharmacy or something like that, I bring my dog, and there are people in public who are very much opposed to it and become hostile towards me, which then alerts my dog, and he will bark. He'd be out of fear because, you know, of our relationship and him feeling like perhaps this person is putting me in jeopardy. And
So my dog will bark, and then that is considered a disturbance, and then we either have to get off of the bus or we have to leave the store. And for me, it's very difficult to have to do that and still be able to function and take care of my life business.
Laura, thank you. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the call and for making that point. In a way, it's a suggestion for training on both sides of this equation. Sarah in Santa Rosa, we just have a very brief moment, so a quick point from you, please.
Thank you. My comment pretty much follows what the panelists were just saying. I've been involved with a legitimate service dog organization for over 20 years and have raised service dogs. And one of my problems with the whole issue right now is I work in a pet store where we have a number of people coming in looking for identification capes or vests for their dogs. They don't have any disability. They don't want to go through training or anything. But what they want is a way to take their animal anywhere they want to, anytime they can, even though they're not meeting them for any kind of reason. And that really delegitimizes, I'm not sure the word, for the people who do have honest disabilities and need their animals where they need to take them.
Sarah, thanks.
I really have a problem with that.
Thanks. Sarah, thank you. Thanks for the call and observation. We're just about out of time. Joe Eskenazi, what are you going to tackle next? I mean, there's lots of material here to follow up.
Well, I certainly will keep my eye on this issue, and I'm certainly happy to stay in contact with all of the organizations in the city and the individuals I talk to. As far as what's next, I'm not sure. I believe that, I mean, you read the story, I don't foresee drastic changes in this city. Because it is, as I think the call from the woman with the neurological disorder put out, this is a very difficult situation. I mean, especially, I mean, over the phone especially. But what I do know is that people who have legitimate needs, I think, are having their – I think that their lives are being cheapened by those who are taking advantage of the system. And also, I think enforcement agencies have very little recourse to do anything about it. And figure it's not worth their time because of the tremendous ramifications if they make a mistake, a huge, expensive, embarrassing federal lawsuit.
We'll have to leave it there and see where this goes from here. Fascinating topic. Joe, thanks for your appearance this morning and for your reporting. Thanks to Jesse Lorenz from the Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired, Susan Misner from the Mayor's Office on Disability, and Rebecca Katz from the Office of Animal Care and Control. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Amanda Stupai, our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our engineer, Howard Gelman, our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.